I hate to say it, and I try to avoid thinking about it when I'm training because it's so messed up, but it's a filthy, dirty sport.
Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. So together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now, here's your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thank you so much for joining me for the latest episode of the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast. I just want to thank you quickly for taking this time to listen to this episode. You know, I know you could do 100 other things with your time, so thanks so much. I truly appreciate it. So last week we talked to Ethan Newbury, aka Ginger Runner, who gave us all a bit of a kick to kind of wake up and go after your dreams and never let anyone tell you that you can't do something. It was pretty inspiring. Today we have an episode I've actually been looking forward to for quite a while. I always thought about bringing him on the show, but to be honest, I wasn't sure I would ever be able to get through to him. He just seemed so busy and I kind of felt like a little bit of a schoolgirl trying to chase down a celebrity. Actually, kind of how I felt when I chased after Brian from Backstreet Boys when I saw him in the airport a few months ago. But maybe not quite that bad. Anyway, Nick Simmons has always been someone I could tell other runners respected and listened to, and I really admired that he was always so honest and just true to who he was. Now, I pride myself on being honest, but Nick takes it to a whole new level, and he really doesn't beat around the bush about anything. He says how it is, even when it's about difficult topics like how USATF runs things or doping, or, you know, you're going to hear more today. So before I tell you too much, let's just dive right in. And after a word from EnduroPax, we'll be right to the interview. Oh, and one more thing. Just remember, the Run to the Top survey for 2016 is now available at runnersconnect.net/listen. And I will be intently listening to you. So I hope you go fill that out. All right, let's get on with the interview. Hydrate naturally by adding EnduroPax electrolyte spray to any drink. EnduroPax has zero calories, no sugar, no sweeteners or artificial ingredients. Yep, you heard that right. Just the electrolytes you need. Visit EnduroPax.com and listen out later in the show for a coupon for 10% off. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Nick.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And, you know, we kind of pulled this together pretty quickly. A few days ago, I spoke to I don't know what she would be to you, maybe one of your agents or someone who works for RunGum, but we got this interview together and I'm really excited about it. So hopefully our listeners are going to learn a lot from you. So I know they're excited to hear from you.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. You were speaking with Shane at ModCraft, is our PR mm-hmm. agency.
Okay.
And they've been wonderful to work with.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I have heard ModCraft for other things, so it was great to work with someone who actually could get this set up. So, okay, firstly, I want to start with, I know the thing that people are going to be very interested in, which is your running career. So just to kind of start it off, I thought maybe I could begin with maybe a highlight so far for you and maybe like a low light or a low moment that you could share both just to kind of show people like where you've come.
Yeah, I mean, I think the highlight of my career, even though I've made two Olympic teams and won six U.S. titles and even a world silver medalist, the highlight of my career is still the 2008 Olympic trials where I became Olympian for the first time. You know, for better or for worse, in professional track and field, there are basically two categories, those that have made an Olympic team and those that haven't. And it's a shame that so much emphasis is placed on that one event. But that's the way it is. And in 2008, when I won the Olympic trials and punched my ticket to Beijing, it really reaffirmed all of the sacrifices that I was making and the hard work that I was investing, that this was the right path for me. And so even though I've had bigger races and run faster than I did that day, that will forever be the biggest moment of my running career.
Mm-hmm. And what, you know, you said about, you know, people, elite runners are basically put in two categories. What is it about the Olympics for anyone listening who, you know, is a recreational runner? What is it about the Olympics that makes it so much bigger than a world championship or any other kind of worldwide event?
I mean, truly, the only reason that it's a bigger event, because actually, in many ways, it's harder to make a world team than it is to make an Olympic team. And the competition out there can be even greater than at Olympic Games. But the reason the Olympics are so important is the fact that the world actually stops to watch. You know, no one's really watching the World Championships in track and field, unfortunately, but, you know, several billion people stop and pay attention to the Olympic Games. So, again, it's, for better or for worse, if you're not an Olympian, you know, it can be really be a struggle out there to raise funds and sponsor money. And unfortunately, especially here in the States, you get so much more support and funding when you have that Olympian title next to your name.
Okay, great. And then what about a low moment? Was there a moment where, you know, you really kind of struggled and you thought, you know, for every runner out there who's listening, maybe they're in that moment and they're thinking, oh, I don't know if I want to keep going with this. I'm really struggling right now. Like maybe a moment that you thought that, but then you overcame it and got out the other side.
Yeah, I think the lowest moment in my career occurred right after my 30th birthday. And it was 2014. I was ranked number two in the world, from the 2013 season and had what could have been a career ending injury that winter. And I don't know if it was just, you know, coming off the high of being ranked number two in the world and winning a silver medal, overtraining, whatever it was, I got an avulsion fracture in my knee and that cost me the entire 2014 outdoor season. It wasn't a major issue in the sense that there was no world or Olympic championship that year, but it was the first season that I hadn't been able to compete ever, you know, since I started running competitively. And I felt a huge sense of loss of purpose, basically. Every morning I woke up and I couldn't run. I just lay there in bed until noon thinking, well, what the heck am I supposed to do with this day? And anyway, I was sunk into a real depression, I won't lie, for several months. And it wasn't until my coach and business partner approached me with kind of a motivational speech, I guess I would say, that it was time to get out of bed and start doing something that basically I should, instead of looking at it as a huge loss of a season, look at it as an opportunity of basically 6 months of free time and utilize that time to do something great. And we decided to launch a business, which we can talk more about. The business is Run Gum. But that business was created out of a really dark moment, you know, that I felt a need to work and I felt a need to have a sense of purpose each day. Mm-hmm. So that was a really low moment for me, but it ended up being one of the best things that ever happened to me, actually, in hindsight.
Yeah. And then with that moment, you know, you said about him, you know, bringing up that you know, starting a business and this idea, was it you already kind of had the idea for Run Gum, or was this like, let's think of something that we can do, and then you just kind of brainstormed until you came up with an idea?
No, we'd been having the idea for Run Gum for years. I'd been utilizing caffeine, taurine, and B vitamins to enhance my performance legally for most of my professional career. I have a degree in biochemistry and had kind of tinkered around with the formulation and knew exactly what I needed. But to bring a product to market takes a ton of time and energy. And as I was training full time, it just wasn't an option. And it wasn't until the injury that kind of bought me 6 months of free time that we looked at each other, my business partner, my coach and I, and said, this is it. If we're ever going to launch Run Gum, this is the window. And as soon as we made that commitment, I was out of bed every morning at 6 a.m. putting in 12-hour days to get this business ready to go. And we ultimately launched Run Gum on October 14th, 2014, I believe it was. And so we're just going to celebrate our second birthday here in a couple weeks.
Oh, that's great. So then would you say for someone listening who maybe is injured right now that finding something else that can kind of, you know, use that time that they are injured or what the extra time that they're not running to find something that they've kind of had in the back of their minds and kind of pursue
definitely.
It a little bit more?
And I'm not saying that everyone needs to go out and start a business necessarily, but you need to find something away from running to give your life, you know, enjoyment and meaning. And it's really counterintuitive because I think to become the best runner or best anything that you want to be takes single-minded focus. And unfortunately, when things aren't going quite right and you can't be single-mindedly focused on one thing, you need an outlet. And, you know, for me, sometimes that's been fishing. For me, sometimes that's been mountaineering. Sometimes it's been working on my businesses, but I think I live a well-balanced life. I think I probably could have been a better runner, a faster runner, if I'd lived that single focused life and invested everything I had into running. But ultimately, when you do that, it can lead to some really, you know, tough times if you don't have that balance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I've talked about this many times in the podcast, so couldn't agree with you more. All right. So you, going back a little bit, you came from a Division III school, and most professional runners come from Division I. So, well, two parts to this. One, do you want to tell people kind of why it's different coming from a Division II or III compared with a Division I, with, like, you know, the resources, you know, what you have access to? And then secondly, did you feel like that kind of gave you almost like a, I don't know, like a chip on your shoulder to kind of prove yourself when you came out because you didn't have all those extra things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very few athletes that make a U.S. team, either World or Olympic, have come from a Division III background or a small school background. And that's because our talent is typically tracked towards D1 universities because there's so much more support there. And you know, I went to Willamette University, a tiny little school in Salem, Oregon, and we had very, very little support or resources. And we're only 45 minutes away from University of Oregon. So each weekend I'd go down there to Hayward Field, and I could see just how many resources my Division I, you know, competitors had. And it pissed me off. It really pissed me off. And I guess I would absolutely say I had a chip on my shoulder. And whether I was racing, you know, Ducks or Huskies or literally anyone I could get a race against, I wanted to be that D3 guy that stepped on the track in a tattered old jersey and kicked the crap out of him. And that's what that was my goal, was to be this kid that no one had ever heard of, from a school that no one had ever heard of, with a jersey no one had ever seen before, that was winning races. And I didn't lose a single 800 my entire collegiate career until I graduated. The first USA championships I ran at, I took second, and that was my first loss, and that happened right after graduation.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that must have been a good feeling. And so why was it you decided to go to a Division III over going to, like, the Ducks?
Well, my focus was in my studies. I was a biochemistry major, so I was pre-med, and I wanted to go on to medical school. And when I talked to a lot of Division I schools, they said, well, here you can't really run and be a pre-med major. It's just too difficult to schedule the practices and the labs. And they said essentially that I couldn't major, you know, in the course of study that I wanted to study. I thought that was ridiculous. The whole thing is, it's called being a student athlete, not an athlete student, but many D1 universities forget that. So when I went to Willamette and talked to them, they sold me with one phrase. Coach Kelly Sullivan, who recruited me to Willamette, said, Nick, at Willamette, you're going to be a student athlete and not the other way around. He said, I will schedule practices around your class schedule. If I have to come out to the track at 8 p.m., if that's the first, you know, time you get free, then that's what I'll do. And no coach, I've talked to dozens of coaches in my recruiting process, not a single coach made that commitment to me. And so it was kind of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. I said, I want to study my butt off. I want to party my butt off, and I want to run, like, you know, as fast as I can. And Willamette was the right choice for me to be able to do all those things.
Mm-hmm. And so then, would you encourage other people, maybe, I don't know, maybe high schoolers listening or people looking at college or even looking at a place to go, to really research into the kind of coach they're working with over being, you know, wowed by all the glamour of, you know, the ritzier places?
Yeah, I think that for every single person out there, there is a program for them. Whether you're a sub-4-minute high school miler or, you know, can't break 6 minutes for the mile, if you want to run in college, you can run in college. If you want to be successful running in college, make sure you find the team that fits you. That might be a D1 program, it might be a D3 program or an NAIA program, but to allow your peers or your parents or coaches or anyone to tell you that the only way to get it done is to go to a D1 university, it's just bullshit. It can be done 100 different ways. It is all about how much you invest in your career. And just like your studies, what you invest in it will pay you dividends. And if you're willing to do the work, you can be successful at any school.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you. That's really helpful. And so then not only did you kind of do that in college, coming out, you know, as a top dog from a Division III standpoint, but also, you know, doing well with that, you kind of almost seem like you always like the underdog. You like being that person that comes when no one expects it, and like working with smaller companies and working from a place where people don't, you know, see you coming in some ways. Obviously, people know your name now, but what is it about being like the underdog or working with, you know, the Brooks over the Nike that you kind of prefer?
Well, I think it comes from my background. You know, I was raised in Boise, Idaho, which certainly isn't the mecca of distance running. You know, I was watching people run much faster in states like Texas or Florida or California, but I was winning national titles in Idaho, you know, in slow times. And I kind of liked the attention that I got, the resources that I got from being one of the top dogs. There's something to be said for being a big fish in a small pond and gradually stepping up in pond size, you know, from Boise, Idaho to Division III to, you know, my first professional squad in Eugene, Oregon, the Oregon Track Club Elite, to now, you know, being part of the Brooks Beast. And it's been a healthy transition for me, a natural transition. But like you said, I like doing it my own way. And even though I ran for Nike for 7 years, I realized that working with that company didn't necessarily fit my personality as well. And so I switched to running for Brooks Running in 2014 and have been extremely happy with that decision ever since.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And, you know, many people listening will know that, yeah, you did have to miss out on the Olympics this year. So do you want to tell us, like, firstly, what happened with that, and then like how things are going since then?
Yeah, so I was about to make my third Olympic team. I had my Olympic qualifier, my workouts were going really, really well, but I fractured my ankle in practice 2 weeks before the Olympic trials. So obviously I couldn't run on it and was forced to watch the Olympic trials from the stands, which was disappointing, obviously, but I think I was able to frame it well in my mind and just feel a sense of gratitude that this was happening now at the age of 32 and not back in 2008 at the age of 24, you know, which could have cost me, you know, the chance of ever running on an Olympic team. So it was frustrating, but I took 6 weeks off and healed my ankle and cheered my teammates on and spent a summer here in the Pacific Northwest fishing and climbing mountains and working on my company, Run Gum.
Mm-hmm. And did that kind of, I just want to kind of go into this a little bit more with, the World Championships, what would that have been, 2 years ago, where you, you know, do you want to tell our listeners about what happened with you refusing to sign the contract? And did that affect the way you felt this year at the Olympics because you'd missed that as well? Or do you think you would have felt the same way regardless of what happened at the World Championships?
Sure. Yeah, well, in 2015, I was asked to sign a document. The USATF, our governing body, asked me to sign a document that basically restricted my rights and prevented me from wearing Brooks running gear at places where I was obligated to do so. Obviously, there's a bit of a conflict between Team USA, which is sponsored by Nike, and many of the athletes that are sponsored by companies that aren't Nike. And so, though I was absolutely happy to wear Team USA gear, and which is Nike gear, at all official team functions, they never bothered to define what an official team function was. And having made, you know, 10 teams before, I knew that USATF was going to use bullying tactics and threaten me, which they've done before, into wearing this gear when I wasn't obligated to. And so I simply asked them to define the terms in their contracts. They used the term official team function in quotation marks numerous times, but never bothered to define what that term is. And so I simply asked them to define that term. They refused to. I refused to sign the contract and was subsequently left off the team, which was frustrating. It was more frustrating being left off that team than missing out on the Olympic Games. I know that sounds crazy, but I had earned my spot on that team, and USATF violated my rights in not providing a well-written, unambiguous document.
Mm-hmm. And do you think, did you think at the time that they would actually go through with it and not take you, or do you think it was kind of like...
Yeah. You know? No, I think we both respected each other enough to know that we weren't bluffing. I certainly wasn't going to back down, and I didn't expect them to back down either. And that's just the way it ended up, you know, and it's unfortunate for them because I was the defending silver medalist and didn't get a chance to compete. And USA, for the first time in, I think it was like 6 years, failed to put an American in the finals, and it made them look bad. It made them look like idiots, which oftentimes they are. but you know, at the same time, I didn't get to go and race for a chance to win another medal, which cost me, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. So I'm proud of the stand I took. I think that USATF needs to be held accountable in many, many different respects, and I'll continue to encourage them to be better throughout the rest of my career and long after.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think gave you, do you think it's like you mentioned earlier about your upbringing and kind of the way you've been raised, in that you've kind of put yourself as this, I don't want to say like sacrificial lamb, but kind of like you have put yourself in the place where you kind of take the brunt of this, and you're like putting yourself as the face of this kind of movement that's happening. But a lot of the professional runners are kind of almost afraid to say anything because of what will happen. But what gives you the confidence to be able to be like, you know what, I'm going to do this no matter what happens. I know I need to do what is right.
Well, the biggest thing is that I have a source of income outside of running, and I never ask runners to put their neck on the line or risk, you know, a paycheck, being able to put food on their family's tables. I understand that many, many athletes depend on that income. You know, I'm in a really fortunate position to have a company, RunGum, that can pay my salary even if all the running income, you know, were to evaporate tomorrow. So I think having that financial freedom is what really allows me to speak my mind and not feel beholden to Nike or USATF or USOC or any of these companies that want to put me under their thumb and try to tell me how to live my life.
Mm-hmm. And for people listening, you know, recreational runners or people who aren't reading up on this, what has become the problem with, you know, Nike, USATF? And do you want to share maybe some of the things that, in your opinion, are wrong that need to change so that if people can kind of get behind this to get this movement going, they can do what they can?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue is that there's a huge conflict of interest when a national governing body uses endemic sponsors like Nike. So USATF's job is to protect the rights of all of its athletes, whether they're sponsored by Nike or Brooks or Adidas or unsponsored. It's their job to protect the rights of those athletes. But when 50% of their budget comes from Nike, obviously they're going to work hard to protect Nike's interests. So here is a nonprofit company or entity that's been placed with the responsibility of protecting all of its constituents, and they're basically acting as an extension of Nike. It's just really, really wrong. Mm-hmm. And we see it time and time again where USATF has done Nike's bidding at the expense of their responsibility towards their athletes.
Mm-hmm. And what is the biggest thing, in your opinion, that most people can do to kind of, is there anything that we can do, the rest of us can do, to kind of help move things to where they're moving in a positive direction?
Yeah, I think it's a really tough one because I understand USATF needs their operating budget. I mean, they need money to operate. There's nothing wrong with that. I think in an ideal world, they would not be allowed to partner with endemic companies like Nike, but that's going to severely cut their ability to raise funds. If they are going to continue to partner with endemic companies, then that money needs to be shared with the athletes. And a recent economic study estimated that only 8% of their revenue was shared with athletes. You know, compare that to NBA or NFL or NHL or these major leagues that have roughly 50% revenue sharing. You know, it's just mm-hmm. It's insulting how little USATF shares with the athletes. So, you know, things that people can do to support the athletes is find an athlete that you identify with and support the companies that they work with. You know, if you're a Nick Simmons fan, I know not everyone out there is a Nick Simmons fan. I'm not asking you to be, but if you are a Nick Simmons fan, support Brooks Running, support Soleus, support RunGum. These are the companies that support me and allow me to train full time. And I think that even if your favorite athlete's a Nike athlete, well, then support Nike. They invest a lot of money in this sport, and I've never had an issue with Nike. But I certainly do have an issue with USATF acting as an extension of Nike.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you. And then you've mentioned it a little bit, and you know, even just there, but for people listening who may not know and may think that elite runners all kind of live this like cushy lifestyle, kind of like a you know NBA player, or kind of have this great lifestyle where they make a ton of money and they just you know sit around and train and sleep and eat and get flown all over the world and private hotels and all this kind of stuff. Do you want to tell us a bit more about, you know, maybe what it's like in reality and just how good you have to be to actually get that very special treatment, kind of what you see through like Mo Farah or someone like that?
As I said, you know, there's two different types of athletes or categories of athletes, those who have made an Olympic team and those who haven't. The next step up of those people is those who have medaled and those who haven't. And if you have a medal, a world championship medal or an Olympic medal, life's pretty good. You get flown around, you get a hotel room to yourself, you know, catered food, you get an appearance fee every time you race. And not for all medalists, you know, there's still some discrepancies and the premier events, whether it's the men's 100 or mile or something like that, are going to be taken care of better. But yeah, I mean, life's good. You know, it's really good. And if you're an Allyson Felix or Usain Bolt, I mean, you might be commanding six-figure appearance fees when you step on the track. So that's a very nice lifestyle. But that's the top 0.01%. Most athletes are living paycheck to paycheck or operating in the red, meaning they're spending more to train and compete than they're actually bringing in, which basically makes it a hobby. You know, for the majority of my career, even I was sharing a room everywhere I went and flying coach and, you know, living in tiny cabins, three people to a room to save costs while we trained at altitude. And I'm not saying it's a bad life. It was still an amazing lifestyle and I loved every minute of it, but it's not the, you know, the MLB or NBA lifestyle, you know, where we're getting chartered around from city to city. It's hard and it's hard work from training. It's hard work competing. It's hard work just traveling, you know, between training locations and competition locations. It is a beautiful lifestyle in that you have a sense of purpose and you're willing to make the sacrifices to see how great you can get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then once you reach that level where you said, you know, you're an Olympic medalist or whatever, is it kind of you keep getting that and, you know, you can kind of make enough connections and make money from, you know, commentating or other things that once you get to that level, you keep making money, or does it fall off very rapidly once you retire?
It falls off very rapidly before you retire even. You know, a defending medalist might enjoy perks for a year or 2 years, but, you know, I think that unless you continue to win medals, all those perks fade away very quickly. And when you retire, they fade away entirely. And unless you've done a great job building up your brand, unless you've done a great job taking care of yourself and have had durability and been around for years and years and years to build up your name, there's nothing left for you. And basically, you go get a job. And that's fine, except for the fact that billions of dollars have exchanged hands on account of your hard work, and the athlete should probably have been compensated a little bit better along the way.
And I'm guessing it's probably quite difficult when you are making that kind of money not to be in that moment and kind of almost forgetting that, putting it out of your mind, thinking like, oh, you know, I made, you know, $300,000 this year. I can buy myself a new car and a new house, and kind of want to almost spend that money thinking that you earned it, even though you obviously have to think about the future as well.
Yeah, I mean, especially if it happens to you when you're young. You know, many pro athletes sign their first deal at the age of 22 mm-hmm. and can have six-figure signing bonuses. And all of a sudden you think, this is insane. I'm crazy rich. It'll last forever. And they're buying boats and cars and houses and, you know, all the fun things that make life really exciting. And they think that they'll be one of these athletes that runs for 10 or 20 years, which the average track and field career is about 3 years. And the money dries up very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a great mentor in Sam Lepre. And he said, you know what, I think you'll be the guy that runs for 10 or 20 years, but be the guy that acts like he's going to have a career ending injury tomorrow. And I always tried to be that guy, whether it was just enjoying the moment of a workout or really embracing the opportunity that each competition represented, or socking away as much money as I possibly could as I was earning it. I always woke up with the idea, or tried to wake up with the mentality, this might be the last day that I ever run professionally.
Yeah.
And I've been living my life that way for 10 years now.
Okay. And that's a good way of doing it. And obviously has definitely worked for you. So something that you kind of got a lot of attention for earlier this year, and I'm interested to see what kind of happened with it, was about selling a patch of your skin. So do you want to kind of tell us about what that was with selling that, and, you know, who bought it off you? Obviously you didn't end up going to the Olympics. So what happened with that spot? And do you get to, I can't remember the name of the CEO of T-Mobile, but, does he get to use it next year, or how does that work with you?
Yeah. So John Leisure, the CEO of T-Mobile, is the one that won the auction. And this is something I did back in 2012 as well. And the winning bid back then was by Hanson Dodge Creative, a marketing agency out of Milwaukee that paid $11,100 for the space. And we doubled that in 2016. And, you know, John is just such a great supporter of the sport, and he was awesome. And, you know, I was able to get T-Mobile some really awesome earned media from that event. You know, it was on the front page of many different publications and websites. But unfortunately, I wasn't able to race, and I think that we could have done some really cool stuff at the trials and at the Olympic Games. But, you know, ultimately, that's the risk of working with professional mm-hmm. athletes. Injury is a very real part of the sport, and whether you're Brooks or T-Mobile or even my own company, Run Gum, sponsoring athletes, sometimes you hit it out of the park, and sometimes athletes get injured, and that's just the way it works.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed any changes in, you know, other people kind of following suit with or getting ready to follow suit with that, with, you know, making temporary tattoos or something for their skin or for other areas, kind of work their way around this?
Well, I hope that they do. I think that athletes have amazing earning potential. Mm-hmm. And I think that unfortunately most of that advertising space has been confiscated by the governing bodies, but slowly and piece by piece, we're starting to wrestle that back. You know, before 2011, I wouldn't have been allowed to wear any temporary tattoos in competition at USATF events. And we threatened them with antitrust litigation. And subsequently, they stopped enforcing those guidelines. So you saw in 2015, I was able to wear my Run Gum tattoos mm-hmm. on my biceps and my shoulders when I raced. And we're going to continue to wrestle back some of that advertising space from the governing bodies through negotiations and through corporate litigation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you did the Run Gum with the on your biceps, like you mentioned, I have to ask, how many times had you practiced doing which pose you were going to do so that it looked exactly right?
Well, you know, ever since I can remember, that was kind of my signature pose, was just to throw up my arms in celebration, whether it was 2008 or 12 or any of them. So that's kind of what I do. And I thought, well, I was only ranked 15th going into the championships. I thought I had an outside chance of winning, but given that outside chance, I said, if I can pull this one off, I want to make sure that I get Run Gum some great exposure. And I was able to do that.
Yeah, no, it was definitely a photo that's been shared around a lot. And then just one more thing about, about sponsoring and about getting messages out and athletes before we move on is, what were your thoughts on Rule 40 for, which is where surrounding the Olympics, for anyone listening, surrounding the Olympics, the sponsors weren't allowed to promote or say anything about the athletes they were, who they sponsor, who were running in the Olympics, because they had to only show USATF, you know, apparel and stuff, if I'm correct with that. If not, correct me.
it's more complicated than that. It controls what you wear, what you say, what you tweet. Rule 40 is a 5-week blackout period where athletes, you know, their rights are absolutely tread upon, and they can't even tweet support of their sponsors if they're not IOC or USOC partners. So the Rule 40 is just a crock of BS. It's absolutely unenforceable. It is the IOC threatening athletes, threatening to revoke their credentials if they don't play by their rules. It's essentially the IOC treating the athletes as employees without compensating them in any way. Whether you're Michael Phelps or some, you know, no-name fencer that no one's ever heard of, everyone's being compensated the same amount by the IOC. $0.00. The IOC does absolutely zero revenue sharing with the athletes.
So this was not just track and field athletics. This is across the board.
Everybody. Okay. Yeah. Okay. All Olympians.
Okay. All right. I didn't know that. So thank you. All right. So let's talk about Run Gum a little bit. We've mentioned it quite a few times so far, but what is it for anyone listening?
Run Gum, in my opinion, is the future of the energy market. You know, I look at all the different sources of energy, Red Bull, 5-Hour Energy, Starbucks, you know, all of these different energy sources, they all have one thing in common. They force you to drink something. And I'm not thirsty. I just want energy. I don't want heavy, acidic, sugary liquid sloshing around in my stomach when I'm trying to perform optimally. I want caffeine. I want taurine. I want B vitamins. These have been shown to have performance-enhancing effects on endurance athletics, and I just want them. I don't want sugar or calories or anything else. So what I did is I took the active ingredients that I wanted, that I just mentioned, and I infused them into two pieces of chewing gum. This gum has zero calories, zero sugar. It's gluten-free. It hits all the bases and provides me a quick, efficient, reliable boost in energy and focus without anything in my stomach to slow me down. So we sell it as Run Gum. A packet of Run Gum retails on our site for $1.50, which is, you know, cheaper than almost any source of these stimulants that you're going to find out there. We sell it at getrungum.com, and you can follow us on social media at Run Gum. We typically say, you know, chew a piece or two for about 5 to 10 minutes before any physical activity. And so these active ingredients have been shown to have performance-enhancing effects up to 3% in some cases on endurance athletics.
Mm-hmm. And then, so would you recommend this for anyone, you know, running anything from, you know, the, I don't know, 400 all the way up to the marathon? Or is this particularly targeted towards a distance group specifically?
No, the science shows that it can help anybody from a weightlifter to a sprinter to distance runners. And we had athletes in nearly every single event utilizing Run Gum at the Olympic trials, and had several Olympic medalists utilizing Run Gum before and even during competition at the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm. And did you find, was it affected in any way by food? Like, did it kind of help people a bit more if they had food in their stomach, or does it really not make a difference?
Well, the beautiful thing about utilizing gum as the delivery vehicle for these stimulants is that you bypass the gastrointestinal track. So GI absorption, you know, what you would do if you were to drink or eat something, is very slow and can be affected by how much you have in your stomach. Not so with Run Gum. The stimulants that we put in Run Gum are absorbed sublingually, and you can absorb them up to 5 times faster than if you were to swallow something. So if you're like me, you want your energy boost when you want it, instantly and efficiently and affordably, and Run Gum hits all those bases.
Mm-hmm. So you would say, for, you know, many of our listeners are marathoners or half marathoners, you would say this is better for them than drinking a cup of coffee the hour before?
I don't want to say better, because it's for each person's own preference. All mm-hmm. I'm saying is, if I'm running a marathon, I sure as heck don't want coffee in my stomach. That mm-hmm. sounds like a horrible way to start a 26-mile run. And I'll say that some world-class marathoners have taped packets of Run Gum to their bottles and will boost their performance along the race at the aid stations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I haven't heard of that, but that's actually, I like the idea of that. And even, you know, people listening, if you're a recreational runner, you could easily, you know, stick a packet of it inside of your shorts. I mean, it's not gonna get in your way or be anything heavy.
So. We actually had a big issue with that. So many marathoners were using it, and they were putting in their shorts or tucking it into their sports bras, and our old packaging wasn't waterproof, and it was a huge issue because so many of our users are marathoners, and so our new packaging, which we just released 2 months ago, is fully waterproof. So all you water sports athletes, whether you're stand-up paddle boarders or swimmers or cycle, anybody that could risk getting their Run Gum wet, it is now waterproof. It comes in 3 great flavors: fruit, mint, and cinnamon. So everyone can find a flavor that they like and start boosting their performance.
Mm-hmm. That's great. We can tell you have been promoting this with you've definitely thought very well through your I don't want to say advertising, but your wording is very elevator pitch.
Yeah, I mean, that's my job. You know, I think, you know, as a CEO, then that's my primary focus now, you know, as I transition into my 30s. My job is to get this the message out about Run Gum. And like I said, I'm a two-time Olympian. I'm a biochemist. I've utilized this product for years now, and it's helped me win races. If anyone can tell the story about Run Gum, it's me, and that's my job. So I hope everyone has enjoyed learning about it. And again, go to getrungum.com and give it a try, and let me know what you think. If you find that it has boosted your performance, if you find that you don't like the taste, I mean, whatever feedback you have, I'm always interested in hearing.
And so you've kind of talked about this becoming your primary focus. Does that mean you are thinking about retiring from running? Is this kind of, you know, the two are equal right now, but this may take over, or how's it, what's the future looking like for you?
Yeah, I think that I could, I think I've got a few more great years of running in me. But again, Run Gum is taking a lot of my focus, and as it demands more and more of my attention, the running will suffer. And I've never wanted to commit to a season without giving it everything that I've got. So I've committed, I haven't totally made the commitment to 2017 yet, but I'm right there. I'm going to have to make a decision in the next month or so. But if I do commit to training for the 2017 season, you can rest assured that it will share focus as my number one priority, along with growing Run Gum for the entire year.
Okay. And, you know, we've mentioned this a little bit earlier, but do you think other athletes or other people who are runners themselves or are athletes themselves should kind of consider making up their own business or setting up a business with something that they have come up with that like solves a problem that they experience during running?
I would encourage anyone with an entrepreneurial spirit to try to bring a product to market or to start a business, because it's a phenomenal life experience and it teaches you so much about the world and about yourself and about people. You know, I've been involved in a few different businesses. Run Gum has been the most rewarding to me thus far. It's challenging. It's hard work, and it will take, you know, number one priority in your life many, many times, is even if you don't want it to, it'll sneak up and demand your attention. But it is extremely rewarding. And if you're successful, in some cases, it might be the only way that you can get, you know, make a decent living while trying to be a professional athlete.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right. And then one other thing I wanted to ask you about before we get to the final kick round. What are your thoughts on kind of what is going on in the running industry? This may be a rabbit hole that we don't want to go too far into at this point in the interview, but about the doping, the drug scandal, the kind of some of the performances at the Olympics that seemed a little bit like fishy. What are your what are your thoughts on what's going on right now?
I mean, I hate to say it, and I try to avoid thinking about it when I'm training because it's so messed up, but it's a filthy, dirty sport. You know, every single week, it seems that some other athlete tests positive or some federation is caught in a doping scandal. And, you know, you think that at 2016, WADA and USADA and all of the anti-doping administrations would have figured out a way to stay ahead of the cheats, but the reality is if an athlete wants to dope, they're going to figure out a way to do it. And it's not that hard to cheat the system, as is evident by, you know, so many athletes that never tested positive while competing. It's messed up. And I honestly, this is above my head. I don't know how to solve this problem. I think that the cheats are so well funded that they'll always be a step ahead of the anti-doping administrations. And it's very disheartening as both a competitor and a fan of track and field to see this take place.
Mm-hmm. And did you find that ever came into your mind when you were training, or like if you were in a race and someone beat you, did that thought cross your mind immediately as soon as you finished? Well, you know, they must be dirty, or has it kind of tainted you or not?
No, I mean, I've always done it clean, and I certainly don't have the body type, the quintessential half miler body type. So it never surprised me if someone beat me. I was just like, well, yeah, I mean, I'm a good runner, but I'm not the best. If David Rudisha beats me, I don't assume he's on drugs. I just look at him and I say, that guy's a half miler. But when I'm training, statistically, I know that people I compete against are dirty. And people I've competed against in the past have subsequently tested positive. There's no way to just go about, unless you're absolutely naive or an idiot, you have to know that people you're competing against are dirty. And it makes it really, really hard to wake up in the morning and train. So, you know, I try to ignore it as best as I can. And I just stick my head in the sand because I can't wake up and train at 100% if I know I'm going into a loaded game.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you think, just one last question here, how much do you think that it is a case of, you know, falling in that gray area where a lot of these athletes don't actually think they're doing anything wrong because they know the level where it's too much, where it crosses into illegal, is a certain number and they go just below that. So technically they're not doing anything wrong. Do you think a lot of it is that, where they're just kind of playing with fire, or do you think people are intentionally knowing that what they're doing is wrong?
You know, this is a real tough one. And I get in arguments a lot with other athletes because my opinion on this is quite different than most athletes. I think that playing in the gray area is something that we all do, whether it's utilizing an altitude machine or, getting intravenous vitamin infusions, utilizing TUEs. In my opinion, all of that falls in the gray area. And it's not our jobs to police ourselves in that gray area. It's WADA's job and USADA's job to set the rules. So a big issue recently has been the abuse of the TUE system. And I don't blame athletes for utilizing TUEs. I think it's not the way I want to do it, and I don't have any TUEs on file. I think I've only used one TUE in my entire career.
What is a TUE for someone who doesn't know?
It's a therapeutic use exemption, so you can utilize drugs that are on the banned list by saying I need them for therapeutic use outside of running. And athletes have been known to really abuse that system. And it's not necessarily their problem. I mean, again, it's not how I want to do it, but it's WADA's job to make sure that that system can't be abused. It's not the athlete's job to police themselves. But that being said, some athletes take that too far, and they utilize banned drugs up to a limit that's called microdosing. And they'll microdose with a banned substance up to a limit where they won't test positive for it. Now, that's straight up illegal. Anytime that you're utilizing a banned substance without a TUE, you have broken the rules and you deserve to not be allowed to compete anymore.
Mm-hmm. And do you believe that once someone is caught once, they should be banned for life? Or what are your thoughts on what's so caught?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no, if you're morally bankrupt that you're willing to cheat your way to the top, there's nothing to say that you are going to all of a sudden have this epiphany that what you did was wrong and not cheat again. I don't trust a single person that's doped before.
Yeah.
Okay. And they shouldn't be allowed to compete.
Yep. Well, thank you. Thanks. And thank you for your honesty. I appreciate that. Not many people, are willing to do that. So we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsor, and then we have 5 more questions for the final kick round.
For years, we were told we needed to be hydrated, drinking gallons of water before we ran. And not only did that mean needing to pee every 2 minutes, but it was incredibly dangerous for our health, as runners suffered from hyponatremia. In step, the sugary, bright-colored syrups to save the day, right? Well, wrong, actually. Not only were they pumping us full of unnecessary sugar and calories we didn't want or need, but they are full of artificial ingredients. Blech. I've been using Enduro Packs for years now, and I can honestly say this is the perfect solution to this problem. Just spray Enduro Packs electrolytes into any drink and be on your way. It's flavorless, other than a slight lemony taste, of course. It has 0 calories, no sugar, no artificial ingredients, and will replenish your electrolytes in a matter of seconds. I love Enduro Pack spray so much that during my marathons, I carry a bottle in my shorts and spray it directly into my mouth during the race. Visit EnduroPacks.com for more information and use coupon code TINAMUA for 10% off.
All right, Nick, just 5 more things for you. Starting off with greatest advice you've ever received.
Wow, that's a tough one. I would say be persistent is the greatest advice I've ever received or can give anyone. No matter what you're doing, whether you're a professional athlete or a businessman or a mom or anything, the most important attribute that successful people have is persistence, because anything worth doing is going to be challenging, and there will always be obstacles that jump in your way. And the people that are successful persevere and find a way over any obstacle.
Yes, I love that. That's great advice. Kind of like the, what do they say? The water cuts through a rock, not by force, but by persistence or something.
Exactly.
I remember the exact quote. Okay, favorite running book or blog?
Wow, there's so many good ones. I would have to say Once a Runner, though. And even though I'm mostly a reader of nonfiction, that bit of fiction is always stuck with me. And I read it when I was really young, and I've probably reread it 25 times. But Once a Runner is my favorite running piece of literature.
Great. What would you like to tell a brand new runner?
I would tell them that consistency is key. You know, whether you're a brand new runner at the age of 12 or 45, you know, once you get the running bug, you think that a little running is great. Well, a lot of running must be really great. And that's just not the way it works. Consistency, running moderately and within yourself and on a daily basis and accruing miles over years and years and years is what makes a great runner. Not running out and going for a 20-mile run tomorrow and then taking 5 days off. It's about piecing it together step by step, day by day. I always say, don't train hard, train smart. And so many people think that training hard is the answer, and it is absolutely the wrong way to do it. It's a great way to get injured. Train smart, not hard.
Yep, absolutely. Couldn't agree more. All right, what is your pre-race meal, if anything?
Well, we usually race in the evenings. The night before, I like to have pasta. I think every high schooler grows up having pasta feeds the night before, and that stuck with me for the last 20 years. But most of our races are a late afternoon, early evening, and I like to have a turkey sandwich about 4 or 5 hours before I race. And then I use, electrolytes and run gum to kind of keep my energy levels up and curb my appetite as I get ready for competition.
Okay, great. All right. And finally, I think we know the answer here. Favorite running product?
You think I'm going to say run gum. And I am. But outside of my own company, I'd have to say the Brooks Ravenna running shoe. And when you're logging in 10 miles a day, 70 miles a week, you know, hundreds of miles a year, thousands of miles a year, your trainer becomes like your best friend. And the day that I left Nike and came to Brooks, you know, I'd heard about their trainers, but I was nervous to switch. And I put a pair of Ravennas on for the first time, and I've never gone back. It's my favorite shoe. And, you know, I plan on putting the rest of my lifetime miles in a pair of Ravennas. Not one pair, hopefully many pairs. They're very generous with their gear. But yeah, I just I throw that shoe on, and it gets my heart going. I just love those shoes.
So if Brooks ever decide they want to discontinue the Ravenna, you might pump a load of money into them and be like, no, you keep this going.
I'd tell them to ship me about 100 pairs, and I'd put them in a airtight chamber, and I'd wait for them. I'd go on and dip in every 300 or 400 miles and grab a new pair.
All right, great. And thank you. That's helpful. And actually, people can definitely check that out. I will put links in the show notes to everything we talked about today, including Run Gum and, all the other things Nick and I have talked about at runnersconnect.net/RC130. So, Nick, thank you so much for your time. Anything else you would like to say to anyone listening or any other, you've told us Twitter and the website, anything else you'd like to mention?
Yeah, if you want to follow me, I'm on social media at Nick Simmons. Run Gum is at Run Gum. And thanks, everyone, for taking the time to let me talk about all these different subjects. I always say nothing's off limits. So thank you to Runners Connect for all the great questions and challenging me a little bit there. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Isn't he awesome? I just love how real he is, especially for someone who's run so damn fast. People like Nick do not come along very often, and I honestly believe we're going to see some much-needed changes in the running world in the next few years, and I think Nick will be the pioneer of those changes. I have also tried Run Gum since this interview, and I have to say, after the initial difficulty of chewing it, it feels like you've been injected with a combination of a shot of confidence and Red Bull, if that makes sense. I noticed a huge difference in the miles following taking the Run Gum during one of my progression runs, and I definitely will be using it during my next marathon. So I'd recommend you give it a try, especially if you do not get on well with those side effects of coffee. We all know what I'm talking about there. And if you use the code RUNNERSCONNECT, you can actually get 10% off on the Run Gum website, which will be in the show notes. So thank you so much for spending this hour with me and Nick. I hope you got a lot out of it, or at least found it interesting. And thank you for the sweet messages, words, shout out, social media messages about this podcast. Keep them coming. They help me know which ones you like the most, so I know to go after those kind of guests.
And speaking of which, remember that the 2016 Run to the Top survey is now available. If you are listening to this in October and November of 2016, I really appreciate your feedback you've been giving so far. And I look forward to hearing what the rest of you think about my second podcast idea. So you can find the survey at runnersconnect.net/listen. So next week, we are going to be talking to another pro. Some of you might have heard of her. Her name is Molly Huddle. Yes, the one and only. And she did finish sixth in this year's Smoking Fast Olympic 10K. And you're going to hear all about how marathon training is going for her as she has her debut at New York next week. You do not want to miss this one. So thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you have a great week.